bâtir des cités idéales, détruis d'abord les monstruosités. Gouvernement, casernes, cathédrales, qui sont pour nous autant d'absurdités.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Disembodied Voice. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be heard 1 week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Thanks for tuning into today's show. We'll be speaking with Andrew Zonneveld, managing editor of On Our Own Authority Publishing, about a collection of essays he edited on the Paris Commune. In the show, we'll talk about the legacy of this important historic event, its lessons for struggle today, non-Eurocentric anti-authoritarian history, and why Voltairine de Cleyre is the bee's knees. Thanks for tuning in. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? I'll call like a boss. For anyone awaiting the election results for Ohio on November 4th, I have some good news and some bad news. The bad news first. It would appear that the corporate mainstream media would have you believe that John Kasich won the election for Ohio governor by a landslide. Personally, I'm skeptical. I noted that the vote tallies didn't even include me, but only listed Kasich and Fitzgerald, the corporate party candidates. By not even listing me, the mainstream media would have you believe that thousands of voters didn't write me in on their ballots, which is totally inconceivable. I mean, think about it. If given the choice, what voter wouldn't vote for an anarchist prisoner held at a supermax facility promising to abolish the state forever? Exactly. So undoubtedly, what we're facing here is widespread vote fraud, possibly the most extensive theft of an election in the history of ever. It's clear that the two hierarch corporate-owned political parties circled the wagons to protect their collective Ponzi scheme against an anarchist insurgent, and they rigged the election statewide. We probably should have seen this coming. I mean, think about it. The Democrats would rather cooperate in a fixed election than let a Republican assume office and still have the hope of winning in the next election rather than allowing the true vote tally to elect an anarchist who will take down the whole system once and for all. So that's the bad news. JWoww is poised to remain sitting in my office, farting in my pleather chair, his stinky sock feet on my desk, digging in his ear with my pen cap, leaving his crusty boogers stuck to the underside of my desk drawer. The travesty. But the good news for all of you freedom-loving black bloc Molotov-chucking insurrectionists out there is that I'm not conceding this election. I've already written a strongly worded letter of protest in red crayon to Ohio Secretary of State John Husted, a dog-swapping hierarch of the Republican variety, demanding that his office immediately conduct a hand count of the votes. I have vowed not to rest until an accurate hand count is achieved. Not surprising, but Husted has not responded in a crayon of any color. You would think from this creepy, irregular silence that the Secretary of State's office has inexplicably run out of crayons altogether. So I have consulted my campaign staff. On their advice, I intend not to concede the election. Instead, in January, when JWoww was being administered a bogus oath in some fraudulent clown show ceremony, I'll be sworn in right here in A Block as Ohio's governor in exile. Yep, your run-of-the-mill constitutional crisis. I and my staff will then contact the ruling hierarchs across the state, Ohio Supreme Court judges, senators, representatives, soliciting their recognition of me as the real governor of Ohio. I'll then start issuing executive orders as governor in exile, all designed to bring about the total destruction of the state of Ohio by February 1st, 2015. That's the day we'll all dance naked around a bonfire where the Ohio State House used to be. If the party gets out of hand, we may end up cooking and eating some former government officials. So if you're opposed to that, I suggest you bring your own hot dogs. Of course, I'll be resigning as governor on February 2nd. My job in Ohio will be finished. Civilization will be a bad memory. Schools and prisons will be squats. The land and National Guard hardware will be in the hands of Native American tribes who lived here before the colonizer came. So that's my plan moving forward. I hope I can count on your support.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional institution and may be recorded or monitored.
In light of the catastrophes we're facing, I think semi-nomadic hunter-gathering deserves another shot. But is Ohio enough? I think perhaps we need to abolish the United States. Yeah, definitely. Want to dance naked around a bonfire where the White House used to be? Write me in for president in 2016. This is Ohio Governor in Exile Elect Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
Can you start just by setting the stage for listeners who might not be familiar with the Paris Commune as a historical event? What was it? What was its importance?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. It's exciting to get to talk about this kind of stuff on the radio. So when I talk about the Commune with folks, I always make a disclaimer that I'm primarily a historian of anarchism and not, you know, don't consider myself any kind of expert on French political history. So I'm sure some listeners and maybe even you guys in the studio might know a lot more about the specifics of the commune than I do. But I can give the quick and dirty version of the commune as I understand it.
That'd be great.
So the way I've always understood the 1871 Paris Commune was that it was the culmination of several years worth of antagonisms between the Paris working class and the French government. In the mid-1860s, the government was involved in a lot of union busting. There was suppressing of anti-government newspapers. This is Napoleon III's government that we're talking about. Anyway, so there was a lot of these antagonisms, as usual, between the Parisian working class and the French government. And really, the outbreak of the Franco-Prussian War was kind of the final straw for this. The French people were so pissed off at their government for getting them into this war that at the end of the conflict, Napoleon III actually surrendered to the Prussians, and what was left of his government was overthrown by a huge front of the French people. And a new government was elected, and that government was under the leadership of this guy named Adolphe Thiers. But he was a parliamentarian who was against the Franco-Prussian War from the get-go. So he seemed like a safe choice. But the Parisian working class didn't trust him either. He was kind of establishment politician, and they didn't want any part of his government either. They really didn't want any new national government. They wanted municipal independence, autonomy, and democratic control over their city organized at the neighborhood level.
Something that was really desired by the Parisian working class even prior to the outbreak of the Commune.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. There were labor strikes and attempts to form a commune before the 1871 events. So this is kind of the culmination of all these conflicts, like I said, that were going on between the Parisian working class and the French government. So that brings us to the actual events of the Commune. On March 18th of 1871, the people of Paris seized control of several cannons that were on the outside of the city and declared themselves an independent commune. Thiers, who was in charge of the government at the time, he ordered the Parisian National Guard to retake the cannons. But the interesting thing about the Parisian National Guard, or the Paris National Guard, I should say, is that they were comprised of a lot of people from these working class neighborhoods. They were very much politicized, very, as far as any kind of unit of the armed forces can be, kind of an anti-authoritarian force. They didn't like to wear uniforms. They wouldn't follow orders if they didn't, you know, decide upon them among themselves. And so they got to where the workers had taken over these cannons, and instead of attacking the workers and retaking the cannons, they turned around and fired on their own generals. So they killed three of their own generals and joined the Parisian workers. So this kind of is recognized as, you know, the moment that the commune is declared and begins to defend itself. Upon achieving control of Paris, the working classes kind of took upon themselves the task of reorganizing and managing their society directly and democratically. Workshops and factories were reopened under collective control of laborers. Rent payments were abolished and elections were held for a communal council that was made up of revocable delegates who were to be directly answerable to the neighborhoods and communities that they represented. The communards advanced a program that abolished military conscription, canceled all rent debts that were owed to landlords, abolished the collection of interest on debts, and numerous other immediate reforms.
And a lot of the people that comment in the book mention the fact that although most of the delegates to the parliament were not socialists or anarchists, some were socialists, some were anarchists, but kind of everyone was acting out of this generally socialistic kind of mindset and enacting these reforms.
Yeah, and they didn't call it the parliament. Like that's the other thing that's kind of hard when you're talking about the Paris Commune is they called the council the commune also.
So, helpful.
Yeah, so sometimes you're talking about the commune or the communards, and you're talking about just generally everybody, like among the Parisian working class. Other times, people are talking about specifically the political entity, right? And on some level, it's like, okay, well, the delegates have no real authority in a lot of situations. They're revocable, so maybe the two are interchangeable. But at the same time, they're really not in this case because a lot of these problems of what the role of this council was going to be were still, you know, undetermined. So it's one of those little confusing things. And depending on who you read, like when you're reading about the commune, especially with writers from the period, you have to quickly figure out who they're talking about when they're saying the word commune. Yeah. And so among all this, they erected these barricades and organized militias to defend the revolution. They held out for 71 days, but on May 21st, Thiers' government retaliated with a murderous campaign that's become known as the Bloody Week. And during this campaign to crush the commune, about estimates vary, but a lot of people say about 30,000 Parisians were killed by the French standing army during this period. So not killed by the National Guard. Because the Paris National Guard was fighting with the commune, but killed by the standing army of the French, with help from the Prussians, ironically.
It's a breathtaking number. I think most folks who know about this event have no idea just how high that number is.
Yeah, it's breathtaking. It is a mass slaughter that is really hard to imagine, especially when you think about in terms of percentage of population. I would love but it would be interesting to see what percentage of the population of Paris that is at that time, you know, in 1871.
Do you have a sense of what proportion of those folks who were killed were even really participatory in the activities? Because, and we'll kind of talk about this later, but there is a question amongst many commentators as to the extent of the participation of just kind of your average everyday Parisian at this time. And so I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, that's something that Voltaire and Duclair really questions a lot. She seems to imply that the majority of people weren't mobilized. And I'm not sure to what degree that's true. I'm not sure to what degree it really matters, because if people weren't actively participating in the defense of the commune, yeah, that's an issue worth talking about. But also, it wasn't like a lot of people were against the commune. Does that make any sense?
Sure, sure. But I think it's important to note that the folks who were slaughtered over this time, you know, they weren't people who were in combat necessarily, They were just being, I guess, picked off the street or in their homes or whatnot.
You're absolutely right. It was a mass collective punishment on the part of the French military, that they weren't out to punish just soldiers or people who were involved politically, but the entire Parisian working class.
And so you touched on this with Voltairine de Cleyre's piece. She's a voice that comes out really strongly for this idea that the working class was not thoroughly mobilized. Other contributors say almost the opposite, that this was a glorious moment of kind of this spontaneous coming to consciousness of the entirety of the working class, and everyone was unified. And I think that kind of speaks to some greater tensions that exist within the book taken as a whole. This idea of it kind of circles throughout all of these pieces when you look at them as a collection. Some folks saying that the commune was a success or will be a success in the future. Some saying it was a failure. Some framing it as this kind of decisive rupture with everything that came before it. And then others saying it didn't go far enough. I'm just interested in your process as a researcher and an editor in this volume. Did you feel those tensions and try to bring them out, or what was your process there?
First, maybe we should let folks know kind of what the book is, because I don't think we got a chance to say that the book is a collection of anarchist and libertarian socialist writings about the commune. Maybe you did say that earlier. Did you say that earlier?
No, I didn't. Thank you.
Yeah, so it's not like me writing a book about the Paris Commune. That's definitely not what the book is. The book is a collection of writings from Louise Michel, William Morris, Mikhail Bakunin, Peter Kropotkin, Voltairine de Cleyre, Alexander Berkman, and Maurice Brinton, and a little foreword by me. Yeah, so what you're asking is, all of these anarchists and libertarian socialist thinkers who one might think are all on the same page and have come to the same conclusions about the commune, it's interesting because there are these tensions between these differing interpretations and differing opinions as to what the legacy of the commune is and how it's impacted the movement for social revolution, you know, in world history. You're absolutely right. There were tensions between these different writers, and that's part of why I love to write the book, because, you get to see different anarchist voices across history trying to understand and interpret the events of the commune and discuss its legacies. And I think that the fact that there are so many differences and tensions speaks to how wonderfully dynamic and diverse anarchism has always been as a political philosophy. But at the same time, there are themes that remain constant throughout every essay in the book. General themes like the necessity for worker self-emancipation, worker self-management, new forms of social organization and direct democracy. The meanings of these ideas are each interpreted differently by each writer, but they're definitely on the lips of each writer at the same time.
One of the themes that comes out in the book really strongly is the idea of leadership. And that there was a kind of spontaneous class consciousness and leadership of the proletariat on the ground. But then also there was the more centralized leadership of the military and political structures of the commune. Some of the contributors to the collection definitely voiced that they didn't think that the commune, that leadership of the commune went sufficiently far in kind of pursuing revolutionary actions, specifically in regard to expropriating capital. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about leadership in the commune.
I think you summed it up kind of perfectly there. There was this obvious tension between the self-organized associations of working class Parisians versus what was becoming the more centralized commune government, who ultimately stood in the way of more revolutionary ambitions from the Parisian working class. This is a constant theme throughout the book. William Morris, Mikhail Bakunin, Peter Kropotkin, Voltairine de Cleyre, Maurice Brinton, all these guys acknowledge this in their essay. Bakunin's essay in particular stands out for the way he interpreted this, because he saw the widespread press coverage of the commune at the time as an opportunity, because he's writing, I think his essay was actually published in 1871, and you know, during that year, newspapers, even like the capitalist newspapers all over the world, were printing this sensational story of the Paris Commune and the things happening there. And, you know, obviously the capitalist press was not portraying the communards in the best light, but everybody was talking about it. So Bakunin seizes this opportunity and he says that, you know, yes, it's true, the commune didn't go far enough, but that they should not be blamed for this. He says that people can't transform themselves overnight. I think that's an exact quote from his essay. And he said that the workers, quote, prove their sincerity to social revolution by putting their lives on the line and being killed for a new vision of society. You know, he points out that the Paris working class might have had some hangups, but their actions showed that they were already more advanced than most of the more authoritarian communist theorists. And I think he's taking a jab at Karl Marx when he says this, because he's saying that the Paris socialists believed the revolution could neither be made nor brought to its full development except by the spontaneous and continued action of the masses, the groups, and the associations of the people. That's a quote from his essay called The Paris Commune and the Idea of the State, which is in the book. And so in that way, he kind of takes a jab at Karl Marx and saying, well, it might not have been perfect, but they, you know, sure knew a hell of a lot more than you did. And I think that's a really interesting and brilliant way to introduce anarchistic ideas to a much wider audience. You know, he saw this opportunity to do that and he did it. And when you read that essay, it's still one of the best short primers on anarchism that you can read. Every time I go back and read it, I'm very surprised at how it really, he really uses that opportunity to expose the nation state for what it is, for being, you know, kind of the eternal enemy of the working class. 100 years later, you have Maurice Britton's essay, which is also in the book. And Britton takes this a step further, and he asks the reader to fundamentally alter the way that we study history, specifically the history of the commune in this case. He says, this is another quote, this is a quote from Britton, that the real history of the commune is the history of the masses themselves struggling for fundamentally different conditions of existence. He says, it is not the history of its leadership. So right there, he's saying everybody wants to talk about what the leadership of the commune did right or did wrong. He says, but we're focusing on the wrong group of people. We need to be focusing on what the working class was doing themselves. Yeah, he said their program, the ideas advanced by the masses of working people in Paris from the moment that they took action reflected, this is another quote, reflected a fundamental preoccupation with the question of destroying at its very roots the hierarchical organization of society. And that's a passage that just really impresses me.
Yeah, and it seems to me that that kind of explains why this event is widely claimed within the kind of so-called canon of anarchism, because otherwise you look and you may not actually find direct references to anarchism or too many anarchists who are actually part of the commune. And so in that context, it kind of helps me understand how this event in general just gets put into the anarchist canon.
Right, because doctrinaire anarchists, they want to look for somebody who calls himself an anarchist and has an anarchist platform being present on the ground. And that's not necessarily what anarchism is about always. So, yeah, that's why I like Brinton's take. You know, another interesting thing he said was that the most significant aspect of the Paris Commune is that it created social forms which serve as yardsticks for proletarian revolutions past, present, and to come. He says, these forms provide criteria for analyzing the social nature of any particular regime. Nearly a century later, societies can still be looked at according to categories established by the Paris Commune. And that to me is very profound, because he's saying that regardless of the shortcomings of the commune, the ideas put forward of, you know, rebuilding society from the bottom up presented, or at least for European society, a whole new way of envisioning the world. And that especially among socialists and anarchists and everybody on the left, those standards are still, like you said, the yardsticks by which, you know, we form our own political philosophies.
And jumping off of that, what are some lessons that you think we might draw from the commune and its relevance today, if at all?
That's a big question.
how are we measuring up on that yardstick?
Oh man, it's that's a tough one. I think that's a question where we need a lot more specifics.
Or maybe in regards specifically to this idea of kind of like the leadership on the everyday leadership of everyone on the ground versus maybe the folks who are looked at as the leaders.
Well, I think that the biggest problem that social movements today are bogged down in is the same problem they've been bogged down in throughout the 20th century. And that's the myth of the progressive ruling elite, right? And so that's kind of the same problem that you see happen at the commune. There's this idea that there can be some kind of centralized political power where we put in these well-meaning individuals and keep our eye on them, and that they will somehow protect our revolution for us. That's what sets, to me, what sets anarchists apart from everybody else on the left, is that by and large, anarchists don't get bogged down in this question of progressive ruling elite. We think a progressive ruling elite is something that can never really exist. So to whatever degree people are bogged down in that, that's not something where I think it's an issue of, you know, quote unquote, false consciousness among the working class. I think most people who talk about false consciousness among the working class are really just trying to be the revolutionary leadership and become the progressive ruling elite themselves. So they can, you know, benevolently govern in the name of the workers or whatever. But they're generally successful in tricking the rest of us into thinking that we can't arrive at freedom on our own terms. So too often, you know, as working class people, we let them take the reins, and that doesn't really work out for us in the end, I think, as has been shown by every single revolution throughout the 20th century.
Yeah. And this really relates to this idea that also circles throughout the book of kind of like trying to legalize the revolution. Almost all the pieces in the book, in some critical way, mention that this was a huge distraction for the commune, and just in terms of their actual day-to-day activities, discussions, and trying to talk to Versailles and all these things, and also like an ideological trap too, that it keeps the proletariat within this kind of paradigm of needing a government. I think, as you mentioned, you know, anarchists maybe are a little bit outside of this because we tend to have a mistrust of the government.
We have other problems, though. But luckily, that's not one of them.
Sure. Well, and I'd be interested to hear what those are from you. But most of the, you know, the communards weren't anarchists. But I think there's a lot of collaboration that happens, right, between anarchists and people who aren't necessarily anarchists. And so that affects the way we struggle, because we're often working with people who don't necessarily have that inherent mistrust of government. So, I mean, maybe this is a similar question to before, but you just mentioned that this has been the way that the 20th century struggle have gone. And I'm wondering if contemporarily today, there's something that stands out to you as what we're getting bogged down in spite of kind of knowing better?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that it's hard to break, you know, to quote unquote, break this habit for the working class. I think that when you look at working class internationally throughout history, you see people breaking this habit all the time, you know, breaking the habit of needing a government.
Could you say more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the commune, the most radical actions of the commune were taken by the Parisian working class themselves before any representatives were elected. They didn't need a government to tell them to seize the cannons or erect the barricades, et cetera, or, you know, abolish rent. These were things that were on their minds already, that they were planning in advance through their own associations and meetings and so forth. You know, those things were decided and carried out by working people directly. And I think we can still see this same proclivity towards spontaneity and self-organization today. I think that you see it to a certain degree in Ferguson, Missouri, though I haven't been there myself, so I can't really speak authoritatively on that. I think you can certainly see it through the history of the civil rights movement and the Black Power movements from the 1950s into the early 1980s. You know, you can certainly see that kind of emphasis on, maybe that's the wrong term, maybe it's not emphasis on, but just the action derived from, action that's born in the self-activity of ordinary everyday folks. You can see it 100, 200 years before that. In the Maroon communities that were established and defended by escaped slaves in the Caribbean and along the Gullah Geechee coast. And by the way, North Carolina folks, there's a great book coming out that deals with that from a couple of North Carolina authors. AK Press is putting it out sometime next year. I think it's called Dixie Be Damned. The subtitle is 400 Years of Insurrection in the American South. They have an excellent chapter in that book that I've been lucky enough to read in advance, related to the history of Gullah and Geechee insurrections in Georgia and South Carolina. And I highly recommend it for anybody interested in that history. And yeah, so I don't know if that's really an answer to your question, but we could say, you know, yeah, there's this problem of the progressive ruling elite, but it's not because of any inherent flaw within working people. It's kind of happened in spite of the ambitions, and in spite of, like you said, the fact that we know better, but we, you know, have unfortunately continued to let ourselves be fooled by so-called progressive leaders and so forth.
So we just need to remember our history when we get confused.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
More after this musical break.
C'est une chose dont on ne parle jamais, la simple affaiblissement des femmes en tant que classe. Pas seulement les femmes violées, monoparentales ou celles qui doivent faire le trottoir pour survivre. Ceci ne constitue que la pointe de l'iceberg. L'ensemble du genre féminin est constamment diminué, et ce, dans toutes les sphères de la société. On nous socialise ainsi, les femmes doivent être sensibles, responsables et ne doivent constituer que l'ombre des hommes. Mais tant que ça cesse, le combat de nos sœurs d'armes est un bon pas en avant.
Combat pour retirer d'arène, remplacé par des gars.
We're speaking with Andrew Zonneveld about his recently edited volume, The Commune, Paris, 1871. This is a pretty specific question, but it came out so strongly to me as I was reading that I have to ask, even if it's just speculation on your part, I'll still be interested to hear the answer. Voltairine de Cleyre's piece, and you kind of mentioned this earlier, stands out really from the rest of the pieces in the collection in that, you know, while most of them are critical here and there, her conclusions are basically what I would call a scathing indictment of the Paris Commune as an almost total failure. And I mean, she's very sympathetic to the folks who were killed, but she is more or less saying that they died in vain, and is kind of adamant that it shouldn't be seen as anything approaching social revolution because, as you mentioned before, in her view, the masses remained pretty, I think she calls them somnambulant. So why do you think her viewpoint was so starkly different from her comrades?
I mean, okay, this is such a great question, and it's a great question for a lot of reasons. One, because I love talking about Voltairine de Cleyre because she is, in my opinion, one of the most brilliant and underappreciated writers in American history, period. And I've always loved doing something with her work. Secondly, it's a great question because you picked up on something that I think most people who read the book haven't picked up on. However, I think that you're wrong when you suggest that her opinion is very different from the other writers. And here's why. Importantly, we got to say that in this book, there are two essays by Voltairine de Cleyre, both of which were published in 1914, 2 years after her death. When they were first written, I don't know. And I can't find anybody who does know. And that was a huge problem for me when I was putting this book together, because there might be some clue as to why she felt this way, depending on what time in her life she was writing or what time in history she was writing. In any event, there's one essay that was published in Mother Earth, Emma Goldman's newspaper. And that essay, she's not so scathing. She is critical in the same ways that Kropotkin is critical, in the same ways that William Morris was critical. But she actually, at times, exalts the Commune. She says, here's a great quote. So from that first essay, she goes, "The Commune went down, as many another Commune will go down. But she went down gloriously with flashing eyes. And wherever the people rise in spontaneous rebellion, recognizing their common brotherhood, there the light flashes out again." Right? So she's not like dismissing the whole thing. She thinks that, you know, it's a tragedy what happened, but that on the whole, it was a step in the right direction. Or I don't know if that's the right way to phrase it, but in any event, she is pro-commune. Now, in the other essay, you're absolutely right. She is much more pessimistic in her view of the Commune, and she kind of has this whole feeling like, you know, the authority's always going to come back. They're always going to kill us until we get our heads right, and there's not really any hope for us getting our heads right, so, you know, we might as well all go home. Maybe that's an oversimplification, but it's a depressing essay. But a lot of the talking points are the same. So there's some similarities and there's some outright contradictions between the two essays. Now, after I published the book, I found out that there's a third article by Voltairine de Cleyre written about the Commune.
The Lost Archive.
And, yeah, it's so stupid. It would stare me right there in the face. It's in Mother Earth, Volume 7, Issue 1. It was published in March of 1912. And that's 2 months before she dies. So if any of her, she dies from meningitis, right? Yeah, in June 1912. So here we have an article that was probably published about the time that she wrote it. So this might give us a clue as to her final thoughts on the Commune. And the title is called, of the article, the other two articles are just titled Paris Commune. And they had the same title, even though they were wildly different articles. This article is called The Commune is Risen. And it's largely reflects what that first article from Mother Earth, you know, how it kind of exalted the Commune. In that article, she says, the Commune was a splendid effort to break the tyranny of centralized domination with which modern societies are cursed. So, and in the article, you know, like any other anarchist writing on the commune, she criticizes the communards for not expropriating the banks. And, you know, she does say, you know, folks didn't go far enough, didn't demand enough. But she doesn't write the whole thing off as meaningless. And she goes further to place the commune in conversations with rebellions that were cropping up all over the world in that year, in Asia, Central America, and Europe. And so she definitely sees it as something that's relevant for the continuing struggle for social revolution through history. So I think that last essay probably gives us a clearer idea of what her thoughts were on the commune, you know, at the end of her life. And I think that that means that the one essay that's so critical, I would wager that it was written before 1911. And the reason I say that is because around 1911, Voltairine de Cleyre gets really, really involved in the Mexican Revolution. And it shifts a lot of the way she's writing, because some other writings that she would write, she would, you know, declare herself an anarchist, but at the same time have doubts about whether or not social revolution was realistic. Once she saw the Mexican Revolution in action, that changed. She believed it was absolutely that social revolution was not only a possibility, but a necessity, and was something that could happen now if, you know, we could get the workers of the world on board. And she became very involved in propagandizing for Ricardo Flores Magón during the events of the Mexican Revolution, obviously until her death in 1912.
That's all so interesting. And I think it really, really speaks to me, one of the most important things about the commune, which is that in its time, its successes and failures can be judged, but certainly in terms of just kind of a revolutionary myth, it really did inspire struggles that happened afterwards. And you kind of note that, like, radicals from Japan to Guyana have been inspired by the events of the commune. And I didn't know until just now about Voltairine de Cleyre's involvement with the Mexican Revolution, but that's a great example too.
Yeah, you know, just if you're ever interested in reading Voltairine de Cleyre, some of her best work, that's really only 1 year of her life. It's the last year of her life. But she wrote so many essays on what was going on in Mexico and was in charge of disseminating so much information to the English-speaking world about what was going on in Mexico. That's some of her best work and some of her most relevant work for a revolutionary organization today.
If it's all right with you, I was going to change gears here for a bit. Sure. And just like ask you about On Our Own Authority Publishing. You're the managing editor, and I'd love to just get your thoughts and experiences with being part of the press.
Yeah. Well, just to speak briefly about it, On Our Own Authority Publishing is an autonomous research press based in Atlanta, Georgia. We were founded in 2012, so we're 2 years old. We specialize in anarchist and radical literature. Specifically, we publish intellectual history, social movement history, studies of global political thought, emphasizing themes of anti-colonialism, direct democracy, workers' self-emancipation, workers' self-management, things like that. The whole thing kind of started, like I said, 2 years ago, well, a little bit more than 2 years ago, when some colleagues and I were talking about some of our favorite radical pamphlets and small books from the Black Power movement and the Caribbean New Left generation. We were kind of concerned and disturbed that some really, really great books and pamphlets that provide a much more anarchistic view of those movements had fallen out of print or had drifted into obscurity, and seemingly nobody, no publisher, no historian was making any effort to bring them back into, you know, the public eye or the eye of movements going on today. So the first project that we worked on was a book called The Bauxite Strike and the Old Politics by UC Quayana. UC Quayana is a revered revolutionary from Guyana. He's been active in revolutionary politics since Guyana's independence struggle in the 1950s. In this book, he It was written around 1972, and he's examining the events of a wildcat strike among Afro-Guyanese bauxite workers that took place in 1970. And that was the book that really started this press. And it's a remarkable book in a lot of ways, and I feel really honored to have been involved in its republication and to have worked with Brother UC, wonderful person. And like I said, we published it in 2012, and we republished it this year in a new edition because it is such a significant book for us that we want to make sure that we keep it around. Our next big project is we have a book coming out written by David Weir, who's the author of Anarchy and Culture. And his new book that's coming out is about the French anarchist filmmaker named Jean Vigo, who film buffs probably know a lot more about than I do. But the book is called Jean Vigo and the Anarchist Eye. And it looks at the history of his films, at the aesthetics of his films, at his personal biography, and at political history of Europe during the early 20th century. And it's a wonderful book. It's already been called by one reviewer the best book on Jean Vigo written in English. So we're very excited to be publishing that. That should be on shelves in January.
I really appreciate the kind of particular flavor of On Our Own Authority, especially in regard to the anti-colonialism. And I was wondering, why do you think some of those texts have like lapsed from their association with anarchism or with maybe just more broadly anti-authoritarianism?
That is such a good question. And I think the answer is a little troubling, and I'm hoping that I don't rub some folks the wrong way. But, okay. Okay, so you talked before about revolutionary myth, right? And there are a lot of myths surrounding the Paris Commune. Of course, the Paris Commune itself was not a myth. It really happened, and there's plenty of lessons to be learned from it and plenty of things that were inspirational about it. But there were myths that surrounded it, and one of those myths was popularized by Karl Marx because he very famously said that the Paris Commune was the first time that working people had challenged the governmental authority of their masters. And that's in Marx's famous essay on the Commune. And it's just simply not true. And it blatantly ignores similar struggles that were being initiated by people of color all around the world. And I can speak a little bit about Guyana because I've studied Guyana to a certain extent. In 1763 in Guyana, this is 100 years before the Paris Commune, there was a massive slave uprising where enslaved Africans in the Berbice region overthrew the Dutch slave owners and the colonial government in the region. And just like in the Commune, only like I said, 100 years before the Commune, you know, these rebels established new forms of direct democratic governance, and they defended their revolution for a year. So they did a little bit better than the Commune did. And the Dutch had to get assistance from the French colonies nearby, from French Guiana, and other colonial powers to help them crush the uprising, which unfortunately they eventually did. And Kofi, who is still like a huge, you know, kind of a legendary figure in Guyana. I mean, people still talk about him. It's like people here talk about George Washington, only Kofi was actually a good person. A good thing. So, but yet, surprisingly, there's almost nothing written about this revolution for, among socialist or anarchist scholars. And so I'm forced to wonder why. And I think that in some ways begins to answer your question as to why anarchists and socialists writers aren't picking up things like UC Kwayan as the bauxite strike in old politics. And I can't speak for everybody else on the left, but I think among anarchists, sometimes there's a real problem where if something doesn't say anarchism on the cover of the book, they just don't read it, mm-hmm. which is really disturbing. You know, I think there's a really disturbing Eurocentric attitude that's, it's historically linked to Marxism, like I said before, but it just bothers me so much because on behalf of school, I traveled to book fairs, you know, in various parts of the country, and I might sell 24 copies of The Commune, Paris, 1871, you know, the book that we're discussing right now. But no one's picking up the book about Jamaica. No one's picking up the book about Guyana. No one's picking up the book about Japan. And of course, I think the Paris Commune is fascinating and interesting, and I think everyone should read about it. But we have to start putting those kind of, like you said, those canonized European revolutionary histories into conversation with these other revolutions that were happening, because if we don't do that, then we can't be genuinely internationalist or even genuinely anti-racist. Right. So that's the myth of the commune that we have to crush, this idea of it being some sort of exceptional event in history. And we got to make that effort to investigate these other struggles and these other revolutions carried out by people of color all over the world in the centuries leading up to the commune.
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that and for providing that kind of context, because I think it's really invaluable for people to hear about. And so, okay, so in this vein, it noted on the website that your current research interests are 20th century Japanese anarchism and political critiques of science and education. So in service of helping us learn a little bit more about some of those non-Eurocentric anarchistic strains, would you mind just telling us a little bit about where you're headed next?
Like I said before, about not being an expert on France, I wrote 6 pages in this book on the Paris Commune. So comparatively, I wrote about a 40-page introduction to a new edition of The Labor Movement in Japan, which was originally written by Sen Katayama in 1918. And I knew that I wanted to do a book about Japanese labor history. That book was in the public domain and nobody else was printing it. So,
and who is this person?
Sen Katayama, he was like a kind of a trade union activist and socialist leader in Japan who eventually became tied in with the Comintern. As an individual, he's not the most exciting personality, you know, for an anarchist to read about, but he was, had his finger on the pulse of everything that was going on in social movements in Japan in the early 20th century. And his account of that era is one of the most important books to read about if you want to read about working class history in Japan, like I said, in the early 20th century. So that's why I wanted to republish the book. And so I wrote this extensive new introduction that kind of put the book into context. And Katayama's book mentions anarchists, but sometimes in an unfavorable light. So in the introduction, I wanted to clarify that a little bit. And the more I read about Japanese anarchists, the more I just became fascinated with this movement. It was dynamic in ways that, you know, I never really thought the anarchist movement could be or had been at that time. And so
could you illustrate that for us a little bit?
You had, for instance, much like in the United States, but to an even more significant degree, the origins of the anarchist movement in Japan were tied in significantly with the origins of the feminist movement in Japan. And you had, you know, some of the women who were involved in this movement, just their personal stories are so heroic and so significant and have so many lessons to teach us that you almost can't believe that we don't know these stories. And that movement was subject to such a high degree of assault by the Japanese state under different emperors, you know, that at various times in its history, they just rounded everybody up and executed them. And then the movement would come back. And it's fascinating. And I don't want to get into too much detail because, you know, of time. Anyway, so I was working on this introduction for this other book. And so I said to myself while I was doing this, I said, well, I have to write a book on Japanese anarchism, because everything I was learning about Japanese anarchism was coming from like just something that was mentioned in a Japanese history book that was dealing with something else.
Right.
There is no, to my knowledge, and I've looked very hard, there's no English language book that's an introduction to the history of Japanese anarchism. In terms of a general history of the movement, it's not there. The only thing that does make that effort is or actually are, two books by John Crump. One is The Origins of Japanese Socialist Thought. The other is a pamphlet that's just called Japanese Anarchism. But the problem is that those two sources, while good histories in some senses, completely erase the role of the feminist movement and the women involved in that movement, and they're just not there, which is a huge oversight once you understand their, you know, their role in that movement in its history. So I wanted to write a book that puts everything back together, put all the puzzle pieces back together, and could present it in a way where it was accessible to the lay reader. And I'm doing that now. I don't know when it's going to be done, but that's what I'm working on.
Very much looking forward to it. Thanks for telling us about that.
Yeah, thanks for asking. I'm like the first person to know that, but it's coming.
We're special. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me on.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Disembodied Voice. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be heard 1 week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. We're speaking to Andrew Zonneveld, editor of the volume The Commune, Paris 1871, and also managing editor of On Our Own Authority Publishing out of Atlanta, Georgia. The book came out in 2013 from On Our Own Authority Publishing, and Andrew is also a co-founder of the press. More about the project can be found at www.OOOABooks.org. Thanks for hanging out with us. We'll see you next time. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher.